Chapter 29. Julia woke the next morning after a fitful night's sleep. Her sense of fear and anxiety had gradually evolved into a feeling of indignant violation. Rising early, she found herself burning with anger. "Who could have known that we discovered the diary?" she said, pacing the floor of the hotel room. "We had only just found it ourselves." Summer was in the bathroom fixing her hair. "Perhaps he didn't actually know about the diary," she replied. "He might have just been trying to find out what you knew and got lucky." "I suppose it's possible. But why the warning? What is it about Kitchener's death nearly a century after the fact that someone would still be afraid of?" Summer sprayed on a touch of perfume, then joined Julie in the bedroom. "I'd say one thing is certain. It has to be someone who knows more than we do about either the manifest or the sinking of the Hampshire." "Or both," Julie concurred. She caught a whiff of Summer's perfume. "That's a lovely fragrance," she said. "Thank you. It was a gift from a friend of mine in British Columbia." "The cologne," Julie suddenly blurted. "I nearly forgot. The intruder who tied me up last night had the scent of men's cologne. I'm sure it was the same fragrance as worn by that fellow we met at Lambeth Library." "You mean Mr. Baker? Do you think it was him?" "I'm not sure about anything at the moment, but I think it could have been him. Don't you remember? He asked us about the diary. I thought it was a bit odd at the time." "You're right. We'll check with the library when we get back to London," Summer said. "I'm sure there's a good chance the librarian will be able to identify him." Julie was slightly relieved, but the revelation only fueled her inquisitiveness. "In the meantime, I say we get on over to Broome Park and see what Aldrich knows about his cousin Emily." They ate a quick breakfast at the hotel, then hopped in the car and drove to Broome Park. 2 miles outside of Canterbury, the car sailed through a deep dip in the road. "Something doesn't feel right," Julie said, detecting a sharp vibration through the steering column. The car struck another small rut in the road, and the passengers felt a sudden jerk, followed by a wail of screeching metal. Summer looked out the window in shock to see the right front wheel bounding ahead of the car and onto the shoulder of the road. The car immediately veered sharply to the right into the oncoming lane. Julie yanked the steering wheel hard left to compensate, but there was no reaction. The wheelless right hub ground into the asphalt amid a spray of sparks as the car careened counterclockwise. The vehicle's 3 remaining tires smoked and squealed as the car spun around and then slid off the road backward. Bounding over the shoulder, the car skidded across a patch of grass before slamming into a low embankment. As the dust cleared, Julie shut off the idling motor, then turned to Summer. "You okay?" she asked, breathless. "Yes," Summer replied, taking a deep breath herself. "Quite a jolt. I'd say we were a bit lucky." She saw that Julie looked pale and still had her hands clenched tightly to the steering wheel. "It was him," she said quietly. "Well, if it was, he'll have to do a lot better than that to take us down," Summer replied defiantly, trying to lift Julie's spirits. "Let's see if we can get back on the road." As she opened her door, a black motorcycle came blazing up the road. The rider slowed slightly, giving the damaged car a long gaze. Then he applied a heavy throttle and roared on down the road. "Don't bother helping us," Summer spat as the black shape disappeared around the bend. She hiked over to the road and found the stray wheel lying on the shoulder. Standing it upright, she rolled it back to the car. Julie had climbed out but was sitting on a large rock, her hands still shaking. Summer opened the trunk and retrieved the jack, then worked it under the front bumper. The ground was hard and mostly level, which enabled her to raise the hub off the ground. Despite some deep scoring on the hub, she was able to mount the wheel, fastening it down with a trio of lug nuts cannibalized from the other wheels. She made sure the lugs were tightened all the way around, then stowed the jack back in the trunk. "Summer, you handled that with ease," Julie complimented. She had regained her demeanor and finally stopped shaking. "I thought we would have to ring the auto club." "My father has been teaching me how to work on antique cars," she said with a proud grin. "He always says that any girl ought to be able to change a tire." Julie surveyed a slight crease to the rear bumper, then handed the car keys to Summer. Do you mind driving the rest of the way? My nerves are shot. Not at all, Summer replied. As long as you don't mind some slow going through any potholes. Taking the keys, she hopped into the right-hand seat and started the car, then eased back onto the road. They felt no more ill effects from the car and soon pulled into the parking lot at Broom Park. The two women entered the manor, finding Aldrich laying out croissants and tea in the garden atrium. Julie made no mention of their auto accident as she pulled him aside for a moment. Aldrich, I wonder if I could ask you about Emily Kitchener. The old man's eyes lit up immediately. Why, Emily was a lovely lady. I was just telling a guest about her last night. She used to love walking the gardens here in the evening to hear the nightingales sing. Hard to believe she's been gone 10 years now. She used to live here at the estate, Summer asked. Oh, yes. My father took her in when her husband was killed in a railway accident. That must have been around 1970. She lived in what's now the Windsor Suite on the top floor. Do you by chance recall her having any friends or associates named Sally? Julie asked. No, I don't recall anyone named Sally, he replied with a shake of his head. Did she ever mention being given any documents or papers from Lord Kitchener? Summer queried. She never made any mention to me of such. Of course, she would have been quite young when the Earl died. You are welcome to take a look at her things if you like. I have a few boxes of her possessions down in the basement. Summer gave Julie a hopeful gaze. If it wouldn't be an imposition, Julie said to Aldrich. Not at all. I can take you down right now. Aldrich led them to his private quarters and through a locked door to a corner stairway. Down the steps, they reached a dimly lit basement, which was little more than a broad corridor that extended beneath a fraction of the whole residence. Aged wooden crates and dust-covered furniture were stacked high along both walls. Much of this old furniture was the Earl's, Aldrich explained as he led them down the corridor. I really must arrange for another auction one of these days. At the end of the corridor, they reached a heavy door sealed with a deadbolt. This was originally a surplus pantry, he said, reaching for the bolt before realizing it had already been pulled aside. They sealed it up tight to keep out the rats. He flicked on an exterior light switch, then grabbed a pull handle and yanked the heavy door aside, revealing a 10-foot-long compartment lined with shelves on either side and a wooden cabinet at the far end. The shelves were jam-packed with cardboard boxes, mostly filled with documents and estate records. Emily's things should be right down here, he said, stepping to the rear and pointing at a waist-high shelf where three boxes were marked E.J. Kitchener. Emily Jane Kitchener, Aldrich said. Might be easiest for you to simply look through the boxes in here. Will you need an escort back upstairs? Thank you, Aldrich, but that won't be necessary, Julie replied. We'll lock things up and find our way out. I hope you both can join us for dinner tonight. We're having a fish fry in the garden. The old caretaker then turned and shuffled out of the pantry. Summer smiled as she watched him leave. He is the cutest little fellow, she said. An old-fashioned gentleman, Julie agreed, pulling two of the boxes to the front of the shelf. Here you go. One for you and one for me. Summer stepped over and flipped open the top of the box, which she noted was not sealed shut. The contents were a disheveled mess, as if someone had hastily thrown the items in the box, or it had subsequently been rifled through. She smiled to herself as she pulled out a baby blanket and laid it on an empty shelf. Next to that, she laid some children's dresses, a large doll, and several porcelain figurines. At the bottom of the box, she found some costume jewelry and a book of nursery rhymes. Box number one is filled with childhood memories, she said, carefully repacking the items. Nothing of relevance, I'm afraid. I'm not faring much better, Julie replied, setting a pair of sequined boots on the shelf. Mostly shoes, sweaters, and a few evening gowns here. From the bottom, she pulled out a flat tray of dinnerware. And some tarnished silverware, she added. The women replaced the two boxes, then jointly opened the third box. This looks more promising, Julie said, retrieving a thin packet of letters. As she began scanning the letters, Summer inventoried the rest of the box. Most of the contents were prized books of Emily's, along with a few framed photos of herself and her husband. At the bottom of the box, Summer found a large envelope that was stuffed with old photographs. No luck here, Julie said, finishing the last letter and inserting it back into its envelope. These are all old letters from her husband. No mention of our mystery girl. I guess the secret of Sally just isn't meant to be revealed. It was an admitted long shot, Summer replied, pulling the photographs out of the envelope and spreading them across the shelf for Julie to see. They were all sepia-tinted images from nearly a century before. Julie held up one photo of a young woman in a riding outfit, holding the reins of a horse. She was a pretty young woman, Summer remarked, noting a delicate face set with penetrating eyes, similar to her famous uncle. Here's one with Kitchener, Julie said, pointing to an earlier photo in a garden setting. Kitchener stood in his uniform next to a couple with their young daughter, clutching a large doll between them. Summer recognized the toddler as a younger version of Emily from the horse picture. She looks about 4 years old there, Summer said, picking up the photo and flipping it over to see if a date was written on the back. She nearly choked when she read the inscription. April 1916. Uncle Henry and Emily with Sally at Broom Park. She shoved the photo in Julie's face. Julie read the inscription, then flipped it over and studied the image with a wrinkled brow. But that's Emily with her parents. Her mother's name was Margaret, I believe. Summer looked at her and smiled. Sally is the doll. By the time the light bulb clicked on in Julie's head, Summer was already tearing through the first box of Emily Kitchener's possessions. In an instant, she pulled out a porcelain-faced blonde doll that was dressed in a checkerboard apron. Holding the doll up in the air, Summer compared it to the one in the photograph. It was the same doll. He said the manifest was safeguarded with Sally, Julie muttered. And Sally is a doll. The two women studied the doll, whose clothes and extremities were well worn from the attentive play of a young girl nearly a century earlier. With tentative fingers, Summer turned the doll over and pulled off its checkerboard apron and matching calico dress. A heavy seam was visible along the doll's back, which kept the stuffing inside. Only the stitching was crude and uneven, not matching the workmanship of the rest of the doll. This doesn't look like the work of an expert seamstress, Summer noted. Julie rummaged through one of the other boxes until producing a tarnished silver dinner knife. You care to perform the surgery? She asked nervously, handing Summer the knife. Summer laid the doll face down on the shelf and began sawing at the topmost stitch. The dull-edged knife was a poor match for the tough catgut thread, but she eventually cut through the first few stitches. Setting the knife aside, she pulled apart the remaining seam, opening up the backside of the doll. Inside was a compressed mass of cotton wadding. Sorry, Sally, she said, carefully pulling out the wadding as if the doll were an animate object. Julie peered anxiously over Summer's shoulder, but slumped when she saw that the doll's torso was filled with nothing but cotton. She closed her eyes and shook her head as Summer pulled out a large ball of it. Silly idea, she muttered. But Summer wasn't through. Peering inside the cavity, she felt around with her fingertips. Wait. I think there may be something in here. Julie's eyes popped open as she watched Summer reach into the doll's left leg and grab hold of an object. Summer worked it back and forth until pulling out a linen-wrapped tube several inches long. Julie leaned closer as Summer set the object on the shelf and gently unwrapped the linen. Inside was a thick piece of parchment rolled into a scroll. Summer held the top edge down, then carefully unrolled it across the shelf as both women held their breath. The parchment proved to be blank, but they soon saw it was protecting a smaller scroll rolled inside. It was a bamboo-colored papyrus leaf with a single column of script running down its center. This must be the manifest, Julie uttered quietly, her eyes locked on the ancient document. It appears to be written in some sort of ancient script, Summer noted. Julie stared at the lettering, finding it familiar. It appears similar to Greek, she said, but it's nothing that I've seen before. That would most likely be Coptic Greek, thundered a male voice behind them. The women jumped at the unexpected assertion. Spinning their heads toward the door, they were shocked to find Ridley Bannister standing in the entry. He was dressed in a thickly padded black leather jacket and pants favored by dirt track motorcycle racers, but neither woman noticed his unusual attire. Their attention was focused instead on the snub-nosed revolver he held in his hand, aimed squarely at their chests.